It's true. Across the globe, women aren't as prosperous as men. Gender inequality is a pressing moral issue, but we forget it has massive economic implications. If you were to put all of the women who don't have access to formal financial services in one place, they would make up the third largest country in the world. That means an entire population without bank accounts, credit cards, or other tools you and I likely benefit from daily. Prosperity for women starts with inclusive policies, products, and people around the globe, and the investment to make it happen. Welcome to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast. My name is Sonia Kelly, and I lead Women's World Banking's proprietary research division. Join me as I speak with changemakers around the globe to deconstruct the social and economic exclusion women face. We'll discover new evidence together and drive action to accelerate women's economic empowerment. Because a leg up isn't a handout, it's a global game changer. Indeed. Welcome and thanks for tuning in to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast, streaming exclusively on LinkedIn. Today, we're talking about finance beyond borders, women's financial empowerment in times of crisis. I'm your host, Sonia Kelly from Women's World Banking. If you are listening live, you will also see me in the chat. You can see me over there if you're on your computer. It's on the right side. If you're on your phone, it kind of pops up. I'm hoping that we're going to be able to have a parallel conversation today over there while I talk with our guest to have a more enriched and interesting discussion. I'm going to also be sharing additional insights and resources as we go along. So don't switch your browser. I want you to be able to catch those things. Before I get started, I want to give a special shout out to Women's World Banking's Making Finance Work for Women sponsors. Our leading sponsor is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Our scaling sponsor is Ernst & Young. Our broadening sponsors are MetLife Foundation and the European Investment Bank. And our supporting sponsors are the Sasakawa Peace Foundation, the United Nations Capital Development Fund, and the International Finance Corporation. We're also incredibly grateful to our core funders at Women's World Banking for enabling our strategy, including Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, and Visa Foundation. And thanks to you for joining. I know that this is such a busy month. September is just nuts. I've been seeing conferences pick back up again. Global fora like the G20 and the UN General Assembly are quite busy. I know we're all feeling the crunch, and that's why I'm especially grateful that you made it here today. I would argue that this topic that we're discussing of women's financial empowerment in displacement or in times of crisis is even more important against the backdrop of those conversations, and we'll get into that today. Today, we're discussing the potential of financial services to meet the needs of displaced women. Before I introduce my guest, per usual, I'll give a bit of an introduction to this topic so we all have a baseline knowledge. I think this is perhaps the most important issue for the financial services industry to be addressing in the next decade. Displaced women are a population that we can't ignore as a financial services community. There are about 100 million people right now who are living in displacement, according to UNHCR. That is double what it was a decade ago. War and climate, changing economic realities have driven this number to twice what it was. And that's something that is so, like, this is multi-causal, and it's something that's just not going away. The UN actually estimates that 80% of climate refugees are women. And the number of people living in displacement is only expected to continue to grow given the drivers of displacement. Now, Women's World Banking has been following the journeys of Ukrainian women who are displaced by war and living in Poland, Romania, and Moldova, recognizing that about 90% of border crossings in the early days of the war were women and their dependents, in part because of a policy that did not allow men of working age who are Ukrainian to leave Ukraine. We're grateful for the partnership of the MetLife Foundation in this work, And there's one story that came out of our research recently that really sticks with me that I wanted to share. There's a woman we talked with named Nadia. She was a nurse practitioner in Ukraine, and she was hiding in a shelter in Mariupol in the early days of the war. She carried with her in that shelter an envelope of her mother's life savings. Her mom actually passed away in the early days of the war, unrelated to the war, unfortunately. And Nadia was sort of living in mourning and living in crisis all at the same time. When she was making decisions about how to leave Ukraine, she decided to keep that money in the envelope in cash because she wasn't sure she would be able to use her bank account in Moldova. When she got to Moldova and was settled in with a host family, her money was stolen by the hosts that she was staying with. She was able to remove herself from that situation, but she was not able to recover her money. She moved into a refugee camp, and she got a job in a toy factory. She opened up a bank account almost immediately after getting her job as a safe place to store her wages, having learned that keeping money in cash was not safe for her. When we talked with her, though, and this is something that is so interesting to me working with women around the world, she emphasized that she still does keep a little bit of money in cash for two purposes. One was to buy bread, and the second was to buy hair dye. And I love this anecdote of her preference for prioritizing cash for hair dye because Nadia still wanted to maintain dignity even as she was living in displacement. And she wanted to make sure that her budgeting and her financial life allowed for that, even as she saves up for the future to return to her home in Mariupol and rebuild her life there. Nadia's story isn't unique. There are many other women who have very similar stories, but it is indicative of some of the things that these women that we're talking to in this research are dealing with. Now, displacement is not a Ukraine story. Ukrainians are about 10% of global refugees around the world. And there are many other refugees that are living around the world that have really difficult stories to tell and that have financial needs that are associated with their journey. This week, leaders from all over the world are descending on New York to discuss both climate crises and progress on the Sustainable Development Goals as at the midpoint of the goals. So this is the UN General Assembly and Global Climate Week. So holding our conversation during this week, releasing a podcast is not an accident. It's actually quite intentional and reflects the role of financial inclusion and the importance of a gender lens in enabling the Sustainable Development Goals and mitigating and adapting to the climate crisis. We just can't ignore women and their financial services in these conversations. At Women's World Banking, we're working on this topic from two angles. Most acutely, how might financial services come alongside of people already living in displacement? We have strong evidence from the MetLife Foundation-funded project that I mentioned that people strongly need financial services once they've established an income stream for themselves in the place where they have resettled. Our research on displaced Ukrainian women in Poland, Moldova, and Romania showed that in times of crisis, women do tend to prioritize cash, and this can be very insecure for them. Second, how might financial services actually prevent displacement in the first place? A couple examples of this are, first, financial services enable people to adapt to a climate-affected world and not need to migrate. And second, financial services create and support economic opportunity to reduce voluntary economic migration. And I think those are really important aspects of our conversation as well. Like, how can we actually prevent displacement? How can we slow the flow of refugees around the world by creating economic opportunity and resilience opportunity where people are right now? So with that introduction, I'd like to welcome our guest, Ina Bielanska. She's the general manager at MetLife Ukraine. Welcome, Ina.
Hi. Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for the invitation and the opportunity to talk and tell the story of really the financial inclusion of Ukrainian displaced women. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we're so glad that you're here. The pleasure is all ours. I always like to start by asking our guests about their origin story. So how did you get into this space of financial services, and why is women's financial inclusion important to you on a broad level?
Okay, I started to work in life insurance almost after I finished and graduated the university in Kyiv. I was just a new subject, and international companies just started to enter Ukrainian market. So actually, I couldn't at that time even find a book about insurance and life insurance. So everything I learned actually being a part of life insurance company. I started to work first in Slovakia as a project manager of startup of the company in Ukraine. And after I just joined the company in Ukraine and actually work here for more than 20 years. And being and working, I mean, in a life insurance, actually, you understand how much it's important, the financial inclusion, how much it's important, the financial literacy of the population, and actually the level of financial knowledge of the people living in your country, because that thing is really you cannot underestimate, especially when you are facing a crisis. And I think I will repeat this in answering some of your questions, just maybe to underline it more and more. And talking about the financial inclusion for displaced women, especially those who forced to leave the country due to the war or other reason, is critical, I believe, for two main reasons. First, women often face greater difficulties integrating into a new society, starting from the lack of professional opportunities to challenges in accessing basic social services. And given that they are often responsible for children and their family members, their access to resources directly affects the well-being of their families. And second, I believe also ensuring women's financial independence is a key element in creating a sustainable and prosperous society, because women with access to resources and opportunities, they can invest in education, children education, health, business, charity, and ultimately in the development of their community. So therefore, the issue of financial inclusion for Ukrainian displaced women not only helps them to adjust personally, but I believe also contributes to positive social changes in a broader level. And personally, this topic is painful for me because both I and my part of my colleagues and part of our clients are also currently displaced. And we communicate with each other and with other women who are forced to leave their homes. But in our case, at least we have a job and we are socially stable. But I know that many women are not, and they are looking for opportunities to support them.
Wow. So, Ina, you're living in Poland as a displaced Ukrainian woman yourself. Like, this is your story that we're talking about today.
Actually, my story completely proves the statistic we have about the displaced women from Ukraine around the world. So, I'm really now located in Poland, and according to the end of the year statistic, there were 1.4 million Ukrainians who moved to Poland after February 24th, 2022. And I don't believe the situation changed significantly, so we can use and trust these numbers. So 85% of these are refugees and they are women. Yeah. So most of them moved, having with them family members to support, means children or the elderly parent. So on average, each such woman has two people on her shoulders. So, and I believe that similar data was provided by 2022 Women's World Bank study. Yeah, 66% of women surveyed in this project left Ukraine with children to support and with parents. It's very difficult and it's very big responsibility, especially when you are in another country. So I personally moved with my child and my mother. So I'm completely like proving that statistics having two people who are dependent on me and they are on my shoulders.
Hmm. Thanks for sharing that. And it's good context to know that this topic is incredibly personal for you. Yeah, it's a real privilege to hear a bit of your story and your reflections, both from your experience, but also from what you've observed around you and from what you're seeing in your work as well, working for a financial services institution serving Ukrainians. What a privilege to have this conversation. You mentioned the Women's World Banking Study and the prevalence of women who traveled with dependents. That's something that we saw very frequently. And one thing that really strikes me as a mother myself is I can't do work while also taking care of the people I need to take care of. So this is something that we saw in our survey was that there were many women who had children and older people that they were responsible for and coordinating care and medicine and appointments and paperwork for all of these people meant that they couldn't go out and look for a job. And even now, a year and a half later, after the start of the war, more than a year and a half later, we've just finished fielding our second survey of three. And we found that employment is only the primary income source for about a third of women. And 31% still rely heavily on humanitarian aid. We asked women as well if they were able to save in order to build a safety net for themselves so that if something goes wrong, they have the money to cover it. And just over half said that they were not able to save to build a safety net. So, you know, the people that we're talking about here are in financial crisis and they can't just solve this financial crisis by going out and earning an income because of dependent care responsibilities and others. So having shared those things with you, I wonder what that brings up for you in terms of what you've seen from your work or from your observations about financial challenges that women are confronting when they're thrust into displacement due to an acute crisis. Like, what are the things that financial services need to be aware of if they're thinking about designing products or following women in their journeys in displacement?
Actually, when we talk about the savings, yes, in my opinion, the roots of many of these difficulties, which we observe now, they can be traced back to pre-crisis time. So the war just catalyzed the problem which existed before. But in our case, Ukrainians didn't want just, you know, to face it. So unfortunately, even in 2021, the level of financial literacy of Ukrainians was very low. So according to the study on financial inclusion conducted by USAID, at that time, only 11% of Ukrainians had savings and investment, and only 8% used personal insurance. So this applies to both like women and men. But considering that average income of Ukrainian women is still lower than the men, it makes it even more complicated for women. And for sure, I mean, what is great in this statistic, yes, you just talk about, is that sort of Ukrainian refugees have work as the main source of income. And it's a very good sign. And I believe that two main things need to be done. First, definitely to increase the percentage of those who are actually having income and job as an income. And I believe it will happen even naturally because we need to understand one thing that first part of the women had to settle their basic needs and their standard of living in a new country. It's not easy. I mean, that's why actually women took with them the grandmothers or mothers to take care of the kids while they are trying to settle their life, find a job. And also, we need to understand that some women actually took a time to learn or improve the knowledge of the language, yeah, to find a better job or to find a job which actually meets their qualification, yeah, in a new country. And for sure, what we observe that the second thing we need to do is to teach women how to properly manage money earned so they become financially secure. So talking about the products, I believe it was really good that Ukraine displaced women could continue to use the financial products and banking products they used in pre-war times. I mean, payment cards, bank deposits, you know, possibility to transfer the income and salary to the banking cards and send money and etc. And I believe that was very important that this service stayed at that point of time with Ukrainian displaced women and continue to be like really the service they use.
I have a couple follow-up questions because this is so interesting, this picture you're painting. One is you mentioned like that decision-making moment at the beginning of someone's journey. Do I take cash or do I rely on my ATM card? And how do I think about financially preparing for a journey with very limited time to prepare? And so I wonder if you can talk us through that decision-making process in terms of women's needs at that moment of decision-making and how financial services institutions might be able to come alongside in that particular moment of crisis.
You know, you're right. I mean, when somebody leaves for the opportunities here, the country, it's more or less, most of the cases, the person is prepared for changes, financially and morally, yeah? So it's somehow planned. In our case, it was not completely planned. Whatever, people somehow thought about that possibility, but nobody could really accept the size of what happened, yeah, and in reality. So, I believe that first thing which everybody, the women need is just feeling the confidence as the main thing. And then you split it to today and tomorrow. And this is how also the financial needs actually you split, yeah? Because for today, you need to find an answer to the questions like where to live, yeah? What to eat, where to find, a school for the child, yeah? And how to get money or protect money from being not stolen because you raise this cash issue, which was completely true. And maybe we talk later about that. And what to wear when the cold weather comes. So, and here was just mostly what's needed is the aid and support, yeah, financial support from the host country. And then for tomorrow is a different thing. And I think for tomorrow is this confidence that displacement will not become an obstacle or put a cross, on the further woman's development. So after completing the basic needs, she will be able to move on and she will not remain for years as a refugee. And here is a different thing. It's about employment, taxation, and other things which financial system can support females in.
I think that's a great point because my guess is that there were very few or no people who were leaving Ukraine who said, oh, I wonder how I'm going to set up a bank account where I'm going. like their concerns were, where am I going to stay? What's the weather? What am I going to need to wear over the next few months? Like, what do I need to pack? And how am I going to access my money immediately? But they weren't saying like, it is my right to get a bank account. How am I going to do that? And therefore, how should I prepare my documents in order to get a bank account? Like they weren't thinking about the financial services themselves. They were thinking about their needs. And I think that's a really critically important
point. You were right. I mean, maybe the specificity of this kind of situation, why people didn't think about the financial thing side first, because it's a migration not for the better life, you know? It's a migration to save a life and to find a safer life for those who lost everything, like this lady you mentioned at the beginning in Mariupol. I mean, you lost everything in the country, of your home country, and you saw something which most probably stay with you and your kids, forever. And these people are just searching for the safety. That's why, I mean, they are not first thing they were thinking about the financial services and even financial support. It was just safety and save a life issue.
And that, Ina, makes my question to you about, like, what do women need in that difficult moment of beginning their journey? Maybe not a fair one to ask of financial services institutions. Like, what they need might be more an address of a safe place to go and instructions on what documents they need for the border and those kinds of things. And you mentioned earlier that in 2021, Ukrainians were not necessarily as financially literate as they should have been. You also mentioned only 8% of Ukrainians had personal insurance. And so that makes me wonder, like, if the critically important role for financial services institutions happens before the crisis to prepare people so that they have a base level of financial literacy, so that they can be, as you said, confident in the financial services industry and also in their ability to manage their finances in the financial services industry and to navigate multiple products they're going to need. Those aren't things you can just teach somebody as they're packing a suitcase. Those are things people can absorb when they're not in crisis, before crisis happens.
Here, I believe that financial institutions' role, I mean, social role even, is just to assure and to promote the financial literacy among the population. And that's also, I'm thinking, like, we are talking, unfortunately, it will not be the last crisis in this world, And if we think about the future and we see potentially that this or that region could possibly face the crisis. And again, some people had to leave the country. That's having the knowledge or financial knowledge is very important, because people are completely lost they are in shock additionally, but this absence of knowledge really make situation even worse. I mean, people don't know the rules. People don't know how much money they could take to cross the border. That's why people were afraid even to declare the money they had with them. I mean, why the people had the money in cash was different thing, and it's actually was very risky, but it was justified approach in such a situation. Yeah, but the people didn't know if they can cross the border with that amount of money. Or maybe the customs of the new country just take this money away. So when they arrived to the country, in the new country, it was even difficult to place a deposit for them. That's why, you know, they faced even the difficulties, you know, and the problems that some money were stolen, because this money were not declared. It's not official money. And we understand that the hosting country is having for sure the rules of financial monitoring and everything for the citizens, yeah, and for local people, which they apply for the refugee. And for sure, many of the problems refugees faced crossing the border could be avoided if there was any knowledge, you know, on the finance and financial services and some knowledge on really the customs and legal issues and basic financial services and support. That's definite.
I have so many more questions, and I'm sure our listeners have questions too. If you're listening and you want to drop questions in the chat for Ina, please feel free. I'm trying to prioritize mine just because of the limited time that we have. So I just have a few more questions for you, Ina. One, it would be a missed opportunity if I didn't ask you about insurance. Can you tell me what aspects of insurance or what aspects of displacement that insurance products directly address? And like, what are you working on in your job?
Okay, so yeah, thank you for this great question, I'd say. So the importance of insurance products cannot be underestimated in general, yeah, and for displaced women especially. And here again, yeah, I want to underline how the level of financial literacy and knowledge of financial product is important in general, yeah, because this knowledge is a life vest for the household. And, you know, many women who left Ukraine, as we discussed, have to take care not only for themselves, but they, you know, and their own health, but also for the health of their loved ones. And considering that the war itself and the change in the usual living conditions, uncertainty in a new city and colossal stress, each individually and all of them together, often hit the health. And for the health of loved ones and for the health of the woman itself. So sometimes such a blows happen very hard and require not only significant costs, yeah, for recovery, but even become catastrophic. So especially when the illness happened to the woman who is a breadwinner of the family. What was needed and actually provided by most of the host countries to all refugees is a state medical health insurance. And it was provided almost immediately or upon registration. I mean, the registration once you have registered as a refugee, which was and is for now extremely needed in case of urgent and critical cases. Still, we all know that in part of the countries, you need to have a private medical and health insurance to protect you and your closest one, because the state health insurance is not covering everything. Or in time, it's like, you know, postpone, yeah, the treatment, yeah, due to some cure line or, I mean, some bureaucracy. So, and unfortunately, at the time we moved, it was not offered such an private health or medical insurance for unless if you are not like having a job, if you are not private entrepreneur, if you are not properly registered because of some financial monitoring requirements, because of the procedures developed by insurance company for actually their own citizens. And what was very good, that now, what for example, in Poland, what I see that insurance companies started to offer such a product for displaced people with simplified procedure of onboarding, which is great. And another good thing, I'm trying always to find something positive, yeah, that part of the displaced women learned about insurance and its great importance, this value for the first time being abroad. So they just realize, you know, how much it's important to have a personal insurance. And I really hope and believe that they will start to use it while they are back home to Ukraine after the war. And if we talk about the Ukrainians who had their policies with us in Ukraine, after some break, people continue to pay the saving policies where they are saving for retirement or education of the kids, and in combination of death and critical illness coverage. So when I talk about the breaks, I mean definitely when clients had difficult to pay life insurance beginning of the war. So the first thing, as we discussed, you're not definitely thinking how to pay my long-term life insurance if I meet a due date, yeah? You are thinking how to escape, how to protect your closest one, how not to forget the documents, which also was the case. You know, the many people came abroad without even having any passports with them. So you are thinking about many different things, but not definitely about your pension plan, which stay in your home country. But what is good, that with some time being settled in a host country, or I mean more or less being adapted to the situation in Ukraine, people continue to pay and keep enforce their policies. But still, what is good, and that MetLife Ukraine actually prolonged the period, so-called grace period we allow the client to pay the insurances, keeping and having them still covered for additionally 60 days. And I'm confident to say that over the past year and a half, we have many cases when insurance payment literally saved people's lives and supported their families financially, and including events that occurred during this grace prolonged period.
Well, you must be really proud of the work you've been able to do. Thank you for sharing. We've talked a lot in our conversation about the financial services industry. Before we close, I want to acknowledge that the financial services industry is not operating in a vacuum. And so in this kind, in this situation, when someone is living away from their home in a different country, and has a series of needs, financial and non-financial, who else should financial services institutions, who else should they be talking with to make progress in this area? What other kinds of institutions, government or private sector or nonprofits or support, what other players should be at the table?
Just put it into three pieces, let's say. So when talking about the level of identifying the problem and the need, I would say it's social services, medical institutions, educational institutions, local communities, everyone who interact with refugees in one way or another, they should be constant source of information for financial institutions. Because it's not always possible to get complete data about the problem from the immigrants themselves, both because of the language barriers and because immigrants do not have always know what is the standard in the host country. And they are basing their opinion solely on the usual experience in the country of origin. Yeah. And, you know, everyone is having their own experience. Since displaced women, like from Ukraine, actually represent three economical classes of the society. So the experience is different. So, and the opinions are different. Yeah. If we are talking about the level of solving needs, I believe that tax officials and legislators should be at the same table together with the financials, because the tax issue is not solved, is not clear. It's actually an obstacle for women to start work in a new country. It's not clear, you know, tax residents, double taxation. Many of them are just afraid to have, you know, to face some problems with the tax office, either in a host country or in a home country when they are back, you know. And actually, there are many questions we cannot anticipate. And I really would like that a lot of attention actually paid to that side of the problem, of refugees being in a host country. And also should be another level, analytics and forecasting. As I said, after all, the waves of migration can go from different directions. Yeah. So in the future and different reasons, like environmental or climate. So therefore, maybe it was predicting in advance such opportunities and direction from which migration can go and think over possible problems and ways to solve them. So based on social, cultural characteristics of the country and potential sources of migrants. So this is what I think.
I had never thought about the importance of tax systems in the context of this this topic, or about data analytics, which is funny because I'm a researcher, like I should think about that. But that's so interesting, and also underscores one of the Sustainable Development Goals, which is the role of partnerships in helping us to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, especially important this week during the UN General Assembly as they think through progress on those goals at the midpoint of the goals. I have so many notes from our conversation. A few things I wrote down for our listeners, just to underscore them, that you mentioned is, one, Ina, you said finance is important before a crisis happens. And so financial services institutions all have a role to play today as we think about the crises of tomorrow. You also mentioned the importance of financial capability and financial literacy, and you said knowledge is a life vest for a household. Never thought about that either, or thought about financial literacy and financial capability as a safety net or a life vest. I really like that image. And then finally, going back to you sharing at the beginning about your story, you said about your job specifically, you said, everything I learned through experience. And there's so much about what we're learning right now as an industry that we don't have a playbook to address. We don't have a textbook that tells us how to deal with people who are in crisis. And we're learning as we go along. And that sort of posture towards learning through experience and taking lessons learned and applying insights for the future, I think is critically important. So those are the things I'm taking from our conversation. I wonder if you have any other final word that you'd like to leave our audience with, a call to action or something else based on our conversation?
You almost concluded everything what we talk about. What I just want to say, we were not prepared, and really the level of financial literacy of Ukrainians was not that high. But really, I observed for this last 1.5 years that refugees and displaced women are not alone. And many people and organizations around the world do care about us. And there is always light at the end of the tunnel, And I want to thank Women's World Banking for being a part of such a support. And thank you for the opportunity to talk and your contribution to the financial inclusion of displaced women around the world. You are doing a great job, and it's so much important for everyone. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ina. Well, you are not alone, and displaced women are not alone. And that's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
To our listeners, what a treat that was. I have a few final notes as we close out. First, you can read our research on Ukraine so far, and we'll put a link in the chat here. I'm just about to put a link here in the chat. Given the data showing financial resilience has not significantly increased for displaced women, in fact, it's decreased for Ukrainian displaced women, our call to action is clear. Financial services institutions need to be a part of the picture before, during, and after crisis. Also, financial services has limited ability to serve displaced people in contexts with poor digital public infrastructure. And this week, I've seen a lot of conversation at the UN General Assembly about digital public infrastructure. We at Women's World Banking just partnered with a coalition to put out a strong set of easy-to-understand recommendations on elements of digital public infrastructure that contribute to women's financial equality. And so you can read that publication, which is called Reaching Financial Equality for Women, at the link that I'm putting in the chat here. And finally, climate is everyone's responsibility. This week is Climate Week. And the financial services community as a whole, if I may say, is late to the game in trying to address climate crises and prepare people for climate crises. We have a research agenda that's focused on climate at Women's World Banking, and I'd like to link to that as well if you want to explore that. Finally, mark your calendar for our next podcast on LinkedIn Live on October 19th, which is the third Thursday of the month. Just so you can remember it, it will always be the third Thursday, as this day is as well. I'm going to be joined by a distinguished guest to explore the potential of gender-focused investment strategy and its viability as an entry point into ESG, which stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance Investing. So I look forward to seeing you then. Thanks again for tuning in, and see you next time.